The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Mark.
Glory to you, Lord.
When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him and he stayed close to the sea. One of the synagogue officials named Jairus came forward. Seeing him, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, saying, "My daughter is at the point of death. Please come lay your hands on her that she may get well and live." He went off with him, and a large crowd followed him and pressed upon him. There was a woman afflicted with hemorrhages for 12 years. She had suffered greatly at the hands of many doctors and had spent all that she had. Yet she was not helped, but only grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. She said, "If I but touch his clothes, I shall be cured." Immediately her flow of blood dried up. She felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. Jesus, aware at once that power had gone out from him, turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who has touched my clothes?" But his disciples said to Jesus, "You see how the crowd is pressing upon you, and yet you ask, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. The woman, realizing what had happened to her, approached in fear and trembling. She fell down before Jesus and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has saved you. Go in peace and be cured of your affliction." While he was still speaking, people from the synagogue official's house arrived and said, "Your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher any longer?" Disregarding the message that was reported, Jesus said to the synagogue official, "Do not be afraid. Just have faith." He did not allow anyone to accompany him inside except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they arrived at the house of the synagogue official, he caught sight of a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. So he went in and said to them, "Why this commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but asleep." And they ridiculed him. Then he put them all out. He took along the child's father and mother and those who were with him and entered the room where the child was. He took the child by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." The girl, a child of 12, arose immediately and walked around. At that, they were utterly astounded. He gave strict orders that no one should know this and said that she should be given something to eat. The Gospel of the Lord. The question we should ask this morning in lieu of the gospel we just heard, rather lengthy passage from Mark chapter 5, 21 to 43 of the verses we heard, is simply this. What can our two co-protagonists teach us? The two co-protagonists are Jairus, the synagogue official, and the woman who was afflicted with hemorrhages for a dozen years. Well, they can actually teach us quite a bit, but I'll only touch upon just a few for our edification and thought this morning. We'll start with the synagogue official, Jairus. Now, to be sure, Jairus is a man of prestige. He's a man of clout. He's a man of worldly honor. He's a synagogue official, which basically puts him pretty much at the top of the social and economic order of the town in which he's in. There's this itinerant preacher milling around in his province. And so absolutely desperate for a solution to his dying daughter, what does he do? The obvious. He goes and seeks out this person who he does not know who he really is, but we know that he has incredible faith in the power of God. And through this experience, he comes to realize exactly who Jesus is, God's only son. This notion, though, of coming to Jesus with desperation extends into another dimension of the narrative. Look at the reaction of the people who basically tell Jairus, "Look, Jairus, I'm sorry, she's gone. Leave him alone. Don't bother him." We can all relate to this moment I mean, imagine, right? The sunken heart of Jairus, right? And so Jesus' perspective is completely like, I got this, okay? And boy, does he. So here's the rub. When Jesus gets to the house, what is the reaction of the people when Jesus says, she is not dead, she's asleep? They ridiculed him. Nice. Okay. They ridiculed him. Okay. And Jesus puts them all out. Good job, Jesus. Okay. Not that he needs me to cheer for him. But here's the distinction between what they're saying and what Jesus is saying. And this is an insight I think we can benefit from. They are looking at the daughter's death from merely a human perspective. It's not surprising. She has just died. And that is an undeniable fact. And of course, if that's not true, then Jesus' miracle is really worthless. Okay, so she's dead. That's it. Okay. But they're only seeing this on the horizon of the natural. You see, this is how our perspective is so limited vis-a-vis God's perspective. Because the Lord knows in his omniscience and his omnipotence what he's about to do. And so, in fact, he is absolutely right. She is not dead. Ultimately, she is just asleep. Because in the divine mind, in divine providence, even death, mortal death, is in a way just sleep. Because this is not the ultimate end of our lives. This is not the ultimate conclusion of the story. This is the most, of course, depressing thing for people who live without faith. I mean, have you ever been through a difficult situation in your life, completely leaned on your faith, realized perhaps how weak at times it really is, but thought to yourself, with even my small nugget of faith in God, what do people do who do not even have a little? Have you ever thought that? That you've been through such a difficult situation that you thought to yourself, this would make absolutely no sense at all if it weren't for the faith perspective that only Jesus can give us through grace. That faith, of course, is given to us at the moment we are baptized, and God willing, it's cultivated throughout our lives. But this even opens up a deeper perspective on what is going on here. And this is something that we often lose sight of. There is nothing that happens in our lives, nothing that happens in our lives, I don't care how minuscule it may seem to you, that is outside of divine providence. Let me say that again. There is nothing that happens in our lives that is outside of divine providence, which loosely defined is God's perduring care, paternal care for the human race. In every single dimension of our lives, there is not a single thing that is outside of divine providence. Now, this should be immensely important to us, especially when we consider not sort of the mushy middle of our lives, but the extremes, the great moments of triumph and victory, but also the immense moments of pain, loss, and suffering. Everything, including the extremes, are inside of divine providence. Meaning to say, nothing is wasted, nothing is lost. God can use every single aspect of our lives. Even St. Augustine admits our sinfulness still within divine providence. Because even sinfulness, God willing, accompanied later by repentance and conversion, can lead us to our ultimate end, which is eternal beatitude. So you see, Jairus' colleagues at the house, their horizon of vision is very, very limited. This is where most of us live, in this very limited horizon. And think about it. When you're hurting, when you're suffering, right, it's very hard to hear what I'm saying. Because you are so insular, you are so tied into, you are so wrapped up in your own self that it is impossible to appreciate a wider horizon that only God can see. Everything is in divine providence. Let's turn then for a moment to the woman with hemorrhages of 12 years. Now, again, another desperate situation. She spent all of her money. That's it. She has nothing left except Jesus. Again, another person who approaches him with deep faith. Now, here's a little bit of the challenge for us living in a country like we live, which is the richest country in world history. And we live in one of the wealthiest places of the wealthiest country in world history. Okay? So this should be even more poignant for us. Years and years ago, about 1700 years ago, there was a heresy in the church called Pelagianism. And of course, like practically every heresy, a priest was responsible for it. Later, Pelagius, who led this heresy called Pelagianism, had a little bit of a conversion of sorts, so he became a semi-Pelagian. What does this all mean? It means this. Semi-Pelagians believe that God's grace only kicks in when I run out of my own resources. In other words, I only lean on God to get me across the finish line. But my perspective, my own sense of myself in the world in which I live is this. God, I know you're out there. Look, I know there are people probably with much more desperate situations, so go help them. All right, as if God is limited in his providence. Okay, just silly thoughts. Okay, so listen, I've got the education, I've got the talent, I've got the charisma and the charm, I've got the financial backing and the resources, so I got this. But listen, if I come into a little bit of a difficulty, I'm just going to need you to kind of give me the extra nudge to get me across the finish line. Okay? This is a very anti-Catholic view of how our lives ought to be led. Again, I turn to Augustine, who says, "If but for the grace of God, there go I." Meaning, I accomplish no good in the world. I do not even exist in the world if I do not first exist in the mind of God. My being, my existence is completely dependent on Him. You see, this is the hubris, the pride of modern man. It's not a modern problem, but we seem to be particularly expert at it. We think, mistakenly, that we're actually self-sufficient. It's the most foolish thing. We think we do it ourselves, and God only makes up for what we lack. This is not Catholic. Excellent Quaker theology. If you like Quakerism, you're a good Quaker. But not good Catholic theology. Because Catholic theology tells us that except for the grace of God, we can do no good in the world. And you see, everything that is good that we do is actually but a participation in the goodness of God. Think about it in just the most basic terms. Did you will yourself into existence? No. Sadly, some of your parents didn't even will you into existence. It's the truth. We're honest. Okay. If we can't will ourselves into existence, how on earth do you think we sustain ourselves in our existence? Except for Him. So you see, to argue even subconsciously that I'm a self-made man, nonsense. No one is self-made. Everyone is made in the image and likeness of God. And it is only by divine providence, only by His goodness, that we experience the life that we do, whether good or bad. The last thought I just offer you in regards to today's gospel is this. Jairus and the woman of hemorrhages of 12 years pray with desperation. They pray like desperate beggars that they are. That is an excellent examination of conscience about our posture of prayer. Do I pray with an air of self-sufficiency? God, I got this. Just help me kind of get past the few obstacles that seem to get in my way. Or do I pray with a sense of utter dependence on divine providence? For every breath I take comes from God's divine, loving, fatherly hands. You see, if you pray with a sense that I'm actually God, and God, you are just kind of like my cosmic rabbit foot or horseshoe that swoops in when I need a favor, you got to ask yourself, in your life, who's God? God or you? This is a tremendous challenge for all of us because we live in a technocracy where we believe that our science, our technology, our skill, our wherewithal, it can solve it all. But we realize there is so much about human existence that cannot be explained simply by human things. Just ask Jairus. How did his daughter get raised from the dead? Was not by human ability. It's the science and the art of looking for divine solutions to human problems instead of just simply trying to rely on human solutions to problems which humans themselves cannot fix without God's divine help. So in the end of all of this, I would just simply say this. Ask yourselves the questions I've put before you today. Who is really God in your life? God or you plus one God? Because if he's your plus one, you got to flip that equation around so that you can join Paul's words, right? So that it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives within me. Might we have the sincerity of heart, the courage to admit this truth about our existence here on earth, so that as we, God willing, one day exist in heaven, we will truly relish in all that God chooses to give us now and forever. May he be praised now and forever. Amen.